Okay, we're going to start this morning, or this afternoon, with an introduction to joint mobilizations. Okay, our terminal learning objective, you can see here, is basically for you to be able to identify a procedure in terms of positioning, grading the mobilization technique, and the direction of force, and being able to apply that to a patient in a safe manner. Okay? But primarily, this is an introductory course that's going to expose you to those techniques. Right? Different learning steps. We're going to talk about joint mobilizations versus manipulations, what the differences are there. We'll talk about osteokinematic and arthrokinematic motions. And then we'll talk about some normal and abnormal end fields. You should have already heard some of these terms in your prior classes. Right? We're going to apply them now to a manual therapy perspective. Right? We'll talk further about the goals, contraindications, and indications for joint mobilizations. And then we'll talk about how we identify the proper grade, direction of force, and some of the application principles. Okay? So these are in your handout if you want to refer to them further. First of all, a mobilization. Your definition for a mobilization. It is a passive force. So you are applying the mobilization force. The patient is passive. They're doing nothing as part of this force, okay? You apply the force, and you apply it within an available range of motion, okay? You can apply these in various velocities and amplitudes, and we'll talk about that, what I mean by a velocity and amplitude as we go on, all right? But it's a passive movement applied within the available joint range of motion. You compare that to a manipulation. And manipulations are not something that you all do as physical therapy assistants or technicians. But a manipulation is taking, again, a passive movement. The provider is performing the motion, but it is going to be done at the end of range of motion. At the end range of motion, okay? It takes it past that physiologic barrier, if you will, which we'll talk about. We also call these thrust techniques or thrust manipulations. They're always a very high velocity, very quick, very small amplitude. Very small amplitude, meaning a very small amount of movement. Okay? So what's the difference other than within or at the end of range of motion? Okay? First of all, the mobilization is always gentle and slow. The key thing is that the patient can stop the motion at any point in the mobilization. Right. How does the patient stop it? Verbally. Say it again. Verbally. Okay. Please stop. That's one way. How else? Flex. Contract the muscle. All right. If I'm moving a joint, all he's got to do is tighten that muscle. I'm not going to move it. Right. He's going to lock that joint up on me, and I can't move it any further. So the patient has control of the motion that's occurring. All right. And it does not go past that end range. It's within that available range of motion that you're performing. Okay? Now, manipulation is different in that it's, again, high velocity, low amplitude. The patient cannot stop it. All right? Because once I get the patient in a position to thrust, it is so quick that they're not going to be able to stop it by the time I start that technique. Okay? And then finally, it goes past that end range. So I'm taking it past the end range of a joint into that physiologic region or barrier, which we'll talk about. Okay? That clear? Everyone understand the difference there? All right? Okay, a little more terminology, and hopefully this is review. Osteokinematics. Osteo meaning bone, kinematics meaning movement. So osteokinematic is bone movement. This is visible and voluntary. So you can see when the bones are moving, you can see when the patient's moving, and the patient is voluntarily doing that. They're using their muscle force to conduct that motion. All right? So examples, and we call these physiologic motions. You've heard that term before, right? Okay? Physiologic motions of the body are flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, external rotation, internal rotation. Those are all physiologic motions, all right, or osteokinematic motions. Those terms are synonymous, and you will typically hear me refer to them as physiologic motions. Okay? You can see it though, flexion. Everyone saw my shoulder flexed, right? Okay? You compare that to the arthrokinematic. Arthro meaning joint. So these are the joint motions that are occurring between the surfaces of the bones. All right? These joint motions, they are motions that have to occur in order for the osteokinematic motions to occur. All right? So these are all motions that have to occur within the joint to allow that joint to flex or extend or abduct or whatever else it does. Okay? And then finally, these are invisible and involuntary. Okay? They are joint motions. They're occurring deep in the joint. You don't tell your joint, I want you to spin. It's just going to do that as part of your overall osteokinematic motions. Okay? And we'll talk about the different types here. We also call these accessory motions, and that's what you'll typically hear me refer them to. Okay? Accessory motions are the arthrokinematic. Physiologic motions are the osteokinematic motions. Okay? So don't get confused on those synonymous terms there. There are three types of arthrokinematic motions that we're going to talk about. Right? There's a couple others, but we'll talk about three. That's rolling, gliding, and spinning. We'll talk about each one here as we go along. All right? So, a roll. Give me an example of something that rolls. A ball. A ball, as it rolls on the ground, how many points of contact are coming in contact with the ground? Multiple points of contact on the ball come in contact with multiple points of surface on the ground, right? That is a roll. Everyone can picture that, right? When we are rolling something, here's an example of a ball, all right? As I roll this, what's happening to the stick? It's swinging, okay? And we call that angular motion, right? So within a joint, anytime a joint rolls, it's going to result in angular motion of a bone, okay? And typically, not typically, but always, you'll notice that the direction of the roll is occurring in the same direction as the swinging bone. So as I'm rolling from my right to my left, the swing is also occurring from right to left. So it's occurring in the same direction. Make sense? Okay. A slide or a glide. All right. Give me an example of something that's gliding. I'll give you one. Okay. You're driving down the road. You got your tires rolling on the ground, right? You slam on the brakes. What happens? You skid, or you glide, or you slide, all right? So you have one point of contact of the tire in contact with multiple points of surface on the pavement, okay? So this would be an example of a glide, as I'm sliding or gliding that ball on the surface of the table, okay? Now, this typically does not occur alone, all right? Within a joint, we're going to get gliding that occurs at the same time as rolling, and we'll talk about why that occurs in a minute. Okay? The direction of that glide is a result of the joint surfaces. All right? The different convexities and concavities of the joint surfaces are what's going to dictate which direction a joint rolls and which direction a joint glides. Okay? Which we'll talk about. I'm going to get you all doing some mental gymnastics here in a minute. So, dust off the cobwebs. Okay? Spinning. Last one. Spinning. Something that spins is top, right? You have one point of contact on the ball, if it's spinning, or the top, in contact with one point of surface on the table. Okay? So that would be a spin. Just like that. Okay? And again, that's typically not occurring in isolation within a joint. It's going to combine with the rolling and the gliding that occurs within a joint. Okay? So we'll we'll talk about all those. There's a few examples of where that occurs, right? Primarily pronation, supination of the forearm, okay? Within the shoulder, we can externally and internally rotate. So there's some examples of pure spinning that occur within the in the joint, in the body, okay? So please kind of think about all those. We're going to come back to them in a little bit after we talk about some other definitions, okay? But roll, spin, and glide are the three accessory motions that we'll be referring to quite often. Have you heard open pack and loose pack position up till now? All right? So basically, in open pack position, the joint surfaces are separated, okay? They're loose. So the capsule, the ligaments that support that joint are in a state of laxity, if you will, to allow those joint surfaces to move around on each other. That's an open-packed position or loose-packed position, okay? Typically, that's going to be a good position to do joint mobilizations because you can move the joint, okay? The closed-packed position is when those two surfaces are maximally congruent or maximally compressed. And in that position, you've got surface on surface, and the capsule and the ligaments and everything around that joint structure is so tight that what happens? Friction, okay? And now if you're trying to do joint mobilizations, you're trying to overcome friction and the relative tightness of all those capsule structures around the joint. Yes? Oh. Then I guess we won't need to know it for a test. It's good to know, though, okay? Don't freak out. All right? So just know the difference. This is a review, open pack and loose pack positioning. Okay? And why that's important for mobilization. We typically mobilize patients when they're in an open pack or a loose pack position. And if we're really trying to stretch out a capsule, you might progress into a more relative closed pack position, but you never want to get them into that maximally congruent spot because you're not going to be effective in mobilizing a joint. Okay? All right. Barrier concept. Again, before we get into joint mobs, we have to learn about the different barriers that occur within a normal joint. And you've heard these before, right? Enfields. Have you learned the term enfields, correct? Okay. So every joint has normal barriers to motion. What we don't want to do is have these abnormal barriers, obviously, because that tells us that there's pathology or dysfunction within that particular joint. Okay, when we get an abnormal enfield. My job as a clinician is to identify those normal and abnormal enfields, okay? And I use that to help me diagnose patients, okay? Okay, that's a patient that can't fully extend and they have that bone-on-bone feel at 30 degrees of extension, okay? That's not normal, and it's my job to be able to pick that up and use that in my diagnosis. It's your job, if you're going to be doing joint mobilizations, it's going to be your job to be able to feel those abnormal enfields so that as you're applying those joint mobilizations, you can affect a change in that, okay? And that's what we'll get into here as we go along. So this barrier concept, we all have normal, active, and passive ranges of motion. You've been through your range of motion class, right? I hope. So if we look at the elbow, everyone flex your elbow up. All right? We would call that the end of active or passive motion? Active motion. All right? Now, what happens if you take your other hand and push into it? It goes further though, right? So our passive motion into shoulder or elbow flexion is larger than what you can do actively. Okay? The muscle will only take it so far, but an outside force can take it further. And that's true of almost every joint. Even elbow flexion, which seems to lock out at the end range, you can actually take it and push it further. It doesn't feel good, but you can push it further into that barrier. Okay? Very small passive motion there, very large passive motion in flexion. That makes sense? So what you have here is that delta between the two where active motion stops and where passive motion stops. Okay? And I'm sorry, this is not calibrated. I didn't draw that bad. Okay? But that difference there between active and passive motion, those are different barriers. The end feel is what you feel at that end point of motion. Okay? So, your job is to be able to assess both the quality and the quantity of that motion. So our normal end feels, just a quick review, bone to bone, right? An example there is what? Elbow extension, all right? You don't know all the anatomy, but the olecranon is buttoned right up into the olecranon fossa. So now I have a bone-on-bone surface. It's going to be a very hard, unyielding end feel, correct? Okay? The next one, soft tissue approximation. Where does this occur? The biceps, elbow flexion. All right? So now I have the biceps button up against my forearm, stopping elbow flexion. I can go further with passive, but that's the end of my active range of motion. Okay? And then tissue stretch. Where's an example of tissue stretch? Okay, shoulder rotation would be an example. All right, if you all take your shoulder and kind of rotate it back, where do you feel a stretch? Right in the front, okay? If someone were to passively take that further, what do you think they'd feel? Kind of a springy feel to it, all right? And that's what we refer to as an elastic end feel or a springy type tissue stretch end feel, okay? So three normal end feels. In your stretching class this morning, did you do hamstring flexibility, assess that? So who was the patient? Did you feel a tissue stretch? Yeah, okay. So that's a type of normal end feel. He may have tight hamstrings, but that's we expect that at that joint, okay? Not anymore? Good. All right, the abnormal end feels. So what should not? What should we not feel in the joints as you're going through these? Bone to bone. That's assuming it occurs in a range of motion where it normally doesn't occur. So if I'm extending my elbow and I have a bone spur there, my motion may stop at 30 degrees and have a very hard, unyielding end feel. Is that normal though? No, because I should be feeling it here, not here. Okay? So bone to bone is anywhere where you get that hard, unyielding end feel where it shouldn't be. Okay? Same with capsular. A capsular end feel is nothing more than a stretch, a tissue stretch. It's normally very hard, a firm end feel, but it occurs in a range of motion that is abnormal. So for me, if shoulder external rotation, if for me normal is up here, and I'm getting a stretch feeling here, well, that could be what we call a capsular end feel that's prohibiting me from going into my full external rotation. Okay? So it's going to be a very hard, firm end feel with a springy stretch to it. Okay? Muscle spasm. I'm sure most of you had muscle spasms before. Okay? That too is going to be a kind of a sudden, hard end feel because of the muscle that's tight and spasmed and restricting that normal motion, okay? So that's an abnormal end feel that you might feel. Springy block. The example of a springy block. Normally this is going to be an internal derangement within a knee or a joint, okay? So if I had a menisci are cartilage structures within the knee that you'll learn about. Okay, if I get a torn meniscus and I've got this piece of meniscus or cartilage floating around on my knee and it gets between the joint surfaces, it can stop my motion because that cartilage is not allowing the joint to go through a full range. And when you get to that, it's going to be kind of a springing. It's going to rebound on you. You're going to push into it and it's going to rebound right back at you. Okay, that's what we're referring to as a springy block. Okay. Then the last one, and probably the most common that you find in pathology, is an empty end feel. Empty end feel is just pain. Okay? So if you sprain your ankle and you can move it about 5 degrees and you have excruciating pain, am I really at the end of your available range of motion? No. I'm at just your point of first pain onset, and that's preventing you from moving further. Okay? So when you're real acute patients or real acute injuries, typically it's pain that we end up working through more often than not. Okay? Pain or an empty end feel. Right. So, having gone all through that, there are many reasons why we perform joint mobilizations. Okay? One, we have to be able to identify abnormal motions. Two, we have to be able to identify those abnormal end feels and identify which directions and which types of techniques we might need to use. But in any respect, that limitation of motion and those abnormal end feels are typically a result of capsular adhesions, the result of immobilization within a joint, sprains within a joint capsule, those internal derangements within the knee or shoulder that we talked about, the menisci, or some of those other causes that we really don't know about. All right? Those are all reasons for joint dysfunction and basically make it a necessity for us to do some sort of joint mobilization to improve that motion. Okay? So, now we go back to the barrier concept and just talk through this. All right? We talked about the normal. You have the active motion and then the passive motion barrier that goes further. All right? That's normal. But what happens when you have joint dysfunction? All right? Basically, what happens if you have a joint dysfunction, your active range of motion is decreased. Okay? Something is stopping you from going through that full range of motion. Okay? So in this example here, if we call this neutral here, this was elbow extension, this is elbow flexion, all right? I should have normal amount of motion to both sides. But in this example, what's lacking? My extension. All right, so everyone reading this correctly? Okay? So I have a limitation in my elbow extension. I can no longer go all the way out to zero, but now I'm stuck here at 30 degrees. And how much flexion do I have? Full, normal, okay? So everyone can see that. So if I have a joint limitation here in elbow extension, what we're typically going to find is a buildup of resistance as you get closer and closer to that end point, okay, that restriction. Typically what happens in the joint is you don't just actively extend it and oops, boom, there it is, there's the end, okay? What typically, if there's a joint dysfunction, what typically am I going to feel as I get closer and closer to that end point? Pain, okay? And why do you think pain is coming on? Because of an obstruction or because I'm starting to stretch or pull on joint structures that are abnormal, okay? So what we find is that there's a buildup. As I get closer and closer to that endpoint, I start in, wow, this is really uncalibrated. I won't even draw on it. I start at some point where I just start to feel some resistance in the joint, and as I get closer and closer to that endpoint, it gets more and more painful and more restricted. Okay? That makes sense to everyone? Your job is to be able to pick that out. So as you're taking a patient through a joint, I should be able to passively extend that elbow and say, ah, he's a little stiff right there, okay? And I keep going, and he starts squawking a little bit, all right? And there's his end point there. I should be able to pick up when that first resistance starts and when that end point is. Okay? Assuming his pain will allow me to do that. Okay? And that's a big assumption. Right? So, what we're going to do is some joint mobilizations. We identify that restriction, that inability to fully extend, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to apply some joint mobilizations to increase that joint. joint range of motion. And that's what we're looking for here. Our goals of joint mobilizations from a mechanical standpoint is to decrease the joint restriction and increase the overall range of motion. Okay? You learned this morning about stretching and what stretching does to collagen fibers. Yes? Okay? It helps you take those collagen fibers from a haphazard arrangement to a more parallel arrangement, right? We're doing the same thing with joint mobilization, but we're doing it into the capsule. So we're taking those capsular collagen fibers and we're stretching them or mobilizing them to get in a more parallel arrangement. We're stressing those fibers, okay? And then also within the joint, you're going to hear me say this more times than not. Motion is lotion, okay? Motion is lotion. You get a joint moving, you start moving that synovial fluid around, oh, wonderful things happen to the joint, okay? Lubrication is the key to joint motion. So we just start to distribute that synovial fluid a little bit. From a neurophysiologic standpoint, what are the goals of mobilization? Bottom line, it's pain reduction. Okay? Pain reduction. Right? Now, it stimulates, and this is just for your knowledge right now, but it stimulates type 1 and type 2 mechanoreceptors to decrease pain. You should know what mechanoreceptors are. You finished your neuro, right? Hopefully. Anyway, the bottom line is what we're doing is we're stimulating these mechanoreceptors and overriding the pain signals. All right? Let me give you an example. You're walking along and smack my knee up against the table. What's my first response? Okay, I scream, yeah. And then what do? Yeah, you rub it. Why am I rubbing it? Anyone ever think about it? Why are you rubbing it? Because when you rub it, you're stimulating those mechanoreceptors. And when you stimulate those mechanoreceptors, it's sending all these signals up to the brain, and it's overriding the pain signals that that knee is sending up to the brain. Okay? That's what we do with joint mobilizations. That's what you do with massage. Okay? You're stimulating all those mechanoreceptors and overriding the pain fiber input to the cortex, to the brain. Okay? Make sense? All right. Just a word of caution here. There are precautions and contraindications to joint mobilizations. All right? You got a list of them there. I don't expect you to sit there and memorize these. Okay? Because frankly, you're not the ones that prescribe joint mobilizations. And if a therapist ever prescribed joint mobilizations to an inappropriate patient, that's on them. Okay? But basically, there's a list. I'm not going to do it for cancerous patients. I'm going to be very cautious if I'm dealing with patients with low bone density. Okay? Healing fracture, all that stuff. Common sense stuff, why you would not do joint mobilizations on a patient. Okay? So they're there. You can refer to them. All right. Now we're getting into the meat of things. When we're applying joint mobilizations, there are four grades. And I will tell you flat out, you need to know these. Star it, circle it. I don't care what you do. Okay? I can flat out tell you it's going to be on the test and people will miss it. Okay? You got to know these over and over and over again. Four grades. Grade one mobilization is when I'm doing a very small amplitude. And what do I mean by amplitude? The amount of force. The amount of movement. Okay? So a very small amplitude or a very small motion that is occurring out of resistance. What's R1? I didn't talk about that. I did, but I didn't call it. R1 is that first resistance. When I'm starting to extend his elbow and the first time I feel some tightness in the joint, that's first resistance. So a grade one mobilization might be here doing these very small motions before I even get to that first resistance. That makes sense? Okay. A grade 2 is a large amplitude or a large amount of motion, and large is relative. Okay? When I'm doing a grade 2, I might have him doing this. Okay? So here's a 1, very small, maybe 5 degrees of motion. Grade 2 might be 10 to 15 degrees of motion. Okay? Good? But in both cases, I am out of resistance. Okay? Grade 3 is a large amplitude in resistance. So this is a patient where I'm doing that large amplitude beyond that first resistance, and typically before I get to that second resistance, or that end point. Okay? And then a grade 4 is a small amplitude, a small amount of motion within that resistance. Okay? Can you memorize that? If this is first onset of resistance, that's his end point, then a grade 3 and a grade 4 can be anywhere between those two. Not necessarily at the end point. It could be right here at the just beyond first resistance. It really depends on the patient, okay? But it's anywhere between first and second resistance, okay? So this is just a diagram that depicts that, all right? You have resistance in the middle. Ones and twos are before you get to that resistance. Threes and fours are after that resistance or into that resistance. Okay? So what determines which of those you use? Have you talked about sins? What's the S? Severity. I. Irritability. N. The nature. S. The stage. Acute, subacute, chronic, right? What's the other S? Stability. Is it getting better, worse, staying the same, right? So if I have a patient that is highly severe, highly irritable, what grade do you think I'm going to use? 1 or 2? I'm not going to go into that resistance. I don't need to go into that resistance to bring on his symptoms, okay? If I had a patient that is low severity, very low irritability, what do you think I'm going to be doing? Probably 3s and 4s, okay? And the reason for that is if I'm using grades 1 and 2 for those severe and irritable patients, I'm typically going to be treating pain. Okay? So I don't need to go into resistance to feel that pain. The patient's going to have pain onset before I get to that first resistance. What type of enfeel is that? Empty enfeel. Okay? So I'm taking that patient into elbow extension, and they have ow, that hurts, stop. I don't feel any resistance there, the stiffness. I'm going to be using a grade 1 or 2, just treating that pain. Okay? Grade 3 and 4. Now I'm working between first and second resistance, so what am I truly treating? Resistance. I'm treating stiffness. I'm treating the joint impairment, for whatever reason that is. Okay? I'm stretching those collagen fibers. I'm making a change to the joint structure. So I'm increasing that motion. Okay? So grades 1 and 2, I'm increasing motion because I'm decreasing pain. 3s and 4s, I'm increasing motion because I'm decreasing stiffness. Okay? So here's your diagram one more time. I've got a loss of motion into elbow extension. I start to feel that pain onset before I ever get to that first resistance. I'm going to be using those grades 1 and 2 around that pain to treat that patient. What happens to the patient's pain as I'm just sitting there oscillating in these small mobilizations? It decreases. Okay? That is the power of joint mobilizations. And hopefully you all will experience that. Okay? Just moving that joint, it's like rubbing the joint. It just settles things down. It decreases the patient's pain. Okay? And then a grade 3 and 4, now I'm in that resistance between R1 and R2, if you will. I keep saying that. If I were to draw this, if I can do it, that would be what? That would be... That would be R1, okay? And R2 would be right there, right? That makes sense? Okay? So when I'm talking between R1 and R2, I'm talking between first and that final or second resistance. That's where you want to be treating the patient. Okay? So that's what determines the force or how much we're going to push into it. Small amplitudes or large amplitudes into pain or into resistance. Okay? Don't force things when you're doing these joint mobilizations. Sometimes all it needs is a little lubrication. Okay? So you get a stuck door. It doesn't necessarily need to slam it. Just spray a little WD-40 on it, right? And then it gets things moving a little bit. That's all we're doing with joint mobilizations. We're just getting that hinge lubricated and getting that joint moving again. Okay? Now, what determines the direction of the force? Here's where we get into the mental gymnastics. All right? It's based on what we call the concave-convex rule. Basically, you have to know your anatomy to be able to apply joint mobilizations. Okay? You have to know your anatomy to do joint mobilizations. You have to know what the joint structure looks like. Okay? So, you all have two bones in front of you as a pair. Just in case, I don't want to insult anyone's intelligence, but we have a femur, we have a tibia, okay? The thigh and the shin, okay? Now, if where those two joint surfaces go together, which is the convex surface? The femur, okay? Convex is the rounded surface. Which is the concave surface? The tibia, all right? So the proximal tibia, the tibial condyles, are concave. They're hollowed out, if you will. The convex surface is the femoral condyles. Everyone with me? So when we say concave on convex, all right, what we're saying there is that the concave surface is the moving surface. Okay? So here's your example. And I'm gonna use this before I get to this. Alright? So my convex surface is the ball, my concave surface is the cup here. Alright? Now, if I want to move my concave on convex, what happens if I just roll? Is that the way the joint moves? What needs to happen? Okay, yeah. It needs to slide as it rolls. That makes sense? If it rolls by itself, it's not going to be congruent. It's not going to extend all the way. If it slides by itself, I'm going to dislocate. So it has to roll and glide or slide together. And when you look at those, are they occurring in the same or the opposite direction? Look at it again. Rolling is going up, and the glide is going up. All right? So when you have a concave surface moving on a convex surface, the roll and the glide are occurring in the same direction. Okay? That makes sense? And then the other way to look at it, the movement of the bone is occurring in the same direction as the movement within the joint. So if I have the roll and glide occurring up, which way is the cup going? It's also going up. Okay? So if you take your bones now, and you get your femur, and have your knee flexed here. All right? Flexed at 90. If you extend, notice how that glide has to occur in order for that joint to stay congruent all the way through knee extension. Okay? Practice it. Just extend without gliding. You see, that's not normal. Glide without rolling. That's not normal. So the roll and glide have to occur together for those joint surfaces to move and stay congruent. And making sense for everyone. Okay? Mental gymnastics, yes. No other way to learn it, though. All right? Good? All right. Convex on concave. All right? So if I have now my concave surface and my convex surface is moving on the concave surface, all right? What happens if I roll and not glide? It just rolls over it, okay? It just rolls right over it. In a joint, that's not a good thing, okay? Because that just results in a dislocation of a joint, okay? So in order for this to roll and to stay congruent with the concave surface, what has to happen? Slide. Which way does it have to slide? Opposite. It's rolling upward, but for it to stay congruent, that slide has to occur downward. So it's coming down as it's rolling up. And what that does is keeps the two joint surfaces right in line with each other. Okay? That makes sense? So on a convex, on a concave surface, the movement of the bone, right? Notice the bone is going up. The movement within the joint is going down. It's occurring opposite. Okay? And the roll is occurring opposite of the glide or slide. That makes sense? So again, using your femur and your tibia, this time keep the tibia stationary. And I want you to extend here. All right? Take your knee from 90 degrees. Okay? And as you come up, right, the osteokinematic motion is the bone coming up this way. So the roll is occurring from my right to my left. The glide is occurring from my left backward to the right. Can everyone see that? Okay? You can feel it as you do that. Okay? Any questions on that? You just got to memorize those. There's no easy way to do that, okay? When I'm typically, or when I get patients or students that are confused, I basically tell them, practice it. Here's your concave surface. Here's your convex surface, all right? So as I'm going convex on concave, the roll is occurring up. The glide is occurring down, opposite, all right? And then switch them. I have a concave moving on convex. The roll is occurring up. The glide is occurring up. Okay? Same and opposite directions, depending on what surface is moving on what. Okay? Questions on that? All right. Here's a neat picture. I got to show you this. This is a patient that has adhesive capsulitis, disorder that you don't know too much about yet. It's basically frozen shoulder. The shoulder does not move, all right, because all the capsule structures around it are frozen up and tight, okay? So this is a patient before we did mobilizations on there. Maybe,